18th board meeting. Corinne, would you call the board members, please?
Yes. Mr. Wilkins.
Here.
Deputy Commissioner Paradise.
Here.
Mr. Kennedy.
I'm here.
Deputy Commissioner Burnett.
Here.
Ms. Brown.
Here.
Mr. Dick.
Here.
Mr. Bruce.
Here. Would you continue with our staff and the public, please?
Okay, since there are a lot of people in this room, as I point to you, please state your name and your organization. We'll start your table.
John Springsteen Data.
Back corner.
Mike Cassie Data.
Toby Rittner with CDFA.
Kent Crandall with ITHC.
Chris Mackey, ITHC.
Deanna Latham, ITHC.
Josh Pepper, Davis, Youth Directors.
Nikki Hall, USDA.
Greg Stuckey, USDA.
Tommy Falkins, Rockhead City.
Back row here.
Ready up with public
protection. And Gallery with the Veterans Office.
Nancy Wainwright.
Joan
Frankovich, National Parks Conservation Association.
Tom Erickson, Veda.
Jennifer Elday, Veda.
Edward Brenner, Alaska Journal of Commerce.
Michael Lamb, Veda.
Eric Johnson, Veda.
Chris Anderson, Veda.
Gary Peterson, Ann. Frank Kempinen, Ann. Do we have any public on the phone? Public on the phone?
Thank you. Thank you. Now, before us is a proposed agenda.
I'll move to approve the agenda.
Second. Any additions, deletions, or comments on it? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Item 5 in our packet is a prior minutes for the meeting. General move December 3rd, 2015.
I'll second that motion.
Any deletions, corrections, clarifications of last meeting? All right. Any dissenting folks on adopting the minutes? No? All right, we'll adopt. Brings us to item 6, public comments. Hearing nobody on the phone, we'll just go to the boardroom here. Please limit, if there's anybody in the boardroom, when I call, we'll call on you for public comments. Please name your name, affiliation, and the subject matter which you wish to make a comment on. So I'll look around. Anybody? Okay, come on up.
Good afternoon, everyone.
You can sit down if you like.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. This is my first time at an AA meeting. My name is Joan Frankovich, and I work for a national nonprofit called the National Parks Conservation Association. We're one of the oldest conservation groups, almost 100 years old in the country, and our mission is to protect national parks for our children and our grandchildren. And I'm here to speak about the Ambler Road Project, and our concern is because the Ambler Road Project would cross state-of-the-art National Park and Preserve. The thing I would like to bring to the attention to the board is, as you're all familiar, Governor Walker had stalled the project to review it, and then when it restarted last fall, $3.6 million has been allowed to continue this process for this project. And I am very concerned with numerous statements in the press that I've heard from Ada and from the governor's office. And I find some of these statements to be very misleading, nonsensical, and maybe even disingenuous. And I wanted to bring those to your attention. The statements on why this project has been allowed to continue are three. One being that to preserve the previous studies that have been done by DOT, the second one is to conduct the scoping portion of the project, to begin that portion of the EIS. And the third one is because the project was stalled mid-step, and it's being allowed to progress to a natural stopping point. I'd like to address each of those. So one of the stated purposes is to preserve the previous studies. Now, I'm not certain about this, but those DOT studies are complete, and I have spoken with some agency people, and they say it's not necessary to continue the process to preserve what's already been done. Those studies are complete. Second thing, the stated purpose is to conduct the scoping portion of an environmental impact statement. And for anybody who's not familiar with an environmental impact statement, the first process is to garner information from the public and from the agencies and information and to determine what they're going to study, what the scope of the environmental impact statement would be, but not, it doesn't actually do the study, just that it's part of it. I have reviewed environmental impact statements and environmental assessments for many, many years. I've probably looked at least 50. I have never seen this, where the stated process of an environmental impact statement was to begin, do scoping, and stop and reevaluate. I've spoken with folks at the National Park Service and the Army Corps of Engineers. They have never seen this. This is, as best I know, this is unprecedented. It's a very strangely stated purpose. And then the third item was that this project was stalled mid-step, and it needs to progress to a natural stopping point. That is completely erroneous. It just happened to be at a stopping point. Beginning the EIS, which has now started with AIDA's application in November, now has started a very lengthy, complicated, long environmental impact statement. So we have just begun to add more money to a process that was at a logical stopping point. So I'm curious, so my question for the board is, you know, why are these misleading statements out there, and would you correct them for the record? Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. We would ask you to direct that question to AIDA, staff, to John Springsteen.
Okay.
You have to direct her by a letter.
Okay.
This is not a question and answer venue. We take public testimony here. Your questions are provided in writing to John, et cetera, directly. I'm sure you're happy to answer them later.
Okay, and you're Mr. Springsteen.
Yes.
Great. Glad to meet your acquaintance, and thank you for explaining the best way to proceed. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify? Public comments?
Good afternoon, thank you, and my name is Nancy Wainwright, and thank you again for the opportunity to address the AIDA board regarding the Ambler Road. I and others have raised many issues to this board about the Ambler Road, and it is because we do feel hurt by this board, and so I want to thank you for that. The board generally, and as I did just a minute ago, direct staff to respond to inquiries of this type, but unfortunately, for almost 2 years, these kinds of responses have not been provided by staff. I went through all the AIDA board meeting minutes, and I selected all the times when board members directed staff to respond or provide a document. And there are too many to go through in my limited time today, but I just want to address two major ones. The first one was in April 2014, when the public was raising questions about the budget for this project. Then Executive Director Leonard stated there was an estimated budget of $42 million and that he would provide that budget to the board at the next meeting. If you look at the next meeting, there is no budget provided. In October of this last year, 2015, I raised this issue again to the board, and the minutes reflect that Chairman Cruz directed the staff members to revisit the Ambler budgets and ensure they are provided to the public and are clear and understandable. Mr. Springsteen agreed to do that. The budget still has never been finally provided. The public and the AIDA board are entitled to know what the project for this, what the budget for this project was, what it is, has it been funded, how much is anticipated to need it to be funded by the legislature in these fiscal times of crisis. So I ask again that issue be addressed. The second issue that has not been addressed is the issue of the potential conflict of interest of Dow HKM. Mr. Wilkin in 2014 June said that a formal a response should be given to the public, and Mr. Dick also requested that. The public has never been provided with a formal response, although AIDA did receive a letter a month after that June meeting from Dow HKM and Mr. Stephen Noble. And AIDA didn't provide that document to the public until more than a year and a half later, in late 2015. when that document was provided, it raises many more questions than it answers. And just by way of analogy, if the state had hired, say, Mr. Cruz's construction company to get permits for, to design a road, to look at routes for a road to his private company, and it was going to be a private road funded by the state, I don't think it would be hard for any of us to see that that would be a conflict of interest. He's gaining a financial benefit from doing these studies that are going to be accruing to him as the beneficiary of the road. Well, that's what happened with Dell HKM. Mr. Noble, who wrote this letter, is one of the true major owners of Dell and has been since 2011. Mr. Noble admits in the letter that Dell worked between 2004 and 2012 on the Arctic and Bornite mineral deposits for NANA, some of which are owned by NANA, and for Nova Gold and Nova Copper. These are the two beneficiaries of this road. He admits that Dell was working for Nova Copper and NANA while doing studies for the Department of Transportation on the Anglo Road. And the letter is not factually correct in even the most basic level. He cites it as Dell HKM as having been worked on this since 2004, but Dell HKM was not even a business entity until 2011. All the Dell companies are subsidiaries of Dell LLC, and we can provide this board with lengthy information about the history of the Dell companies, but basically they're all owned by Dell LLC, and Mr. Noble is one of the two primary shareholders of Dell LLC. We don't know who the others are. He and another partner own 20%. The other 80% are not disclosed. So there's nothing wrong with NANA hiring its subsidiary or Nova Copper hiring NANA's subsidiary to work on a project for itself. But there is a problem when the state of Alaska is using the studies done by NANA, done by their subsidiaries, to benefit NANA and Nova Copper, and not disclosing that or not conducting any analysis of that potential conflict of interest. So I respectfully ask that this board again provide the conflict of interest analysis, not by Mr. Noble, who works for Dell, but by an independent analysis of whether or not there is a conflict of interest.
Thank you. Any questions from the board? Gary?
I'm really tired of hearing about the conflict of interest issue. So could we set a date certain that this board will be briefed and a public opinion be put forth so I don't have to listen to this for another board meeting a year from now?
Yes, we'll have it on the agenda for the March 3rd board meeting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Question. Thank you, Desmond. Anybody else? Public comments?
Hello, my name is John Gaty from Fairbanks. I'm also the chairman of the Brooks Range Council. And I come here today to hold you to your word of investing in Alaskans. ADA bylaws and resolutions speak of authority and power and responsibility for Alaskans. An ADA's proposed road to the Amber Mining District can only be built by ignoring fiscal prudence and the Alaskan community path. I'm one of those Alaskans up there. My family's been up there for over 40 years, and this road would be proposed to go just a few miles away from our place of business. When Alaskans in Bettles and Evansville stood firm against the road proposal through their villages, ADA chose a new, longer, more expensive route with two additional major bridge crossings and an additional piece of Gates of the Arctic to cross that could well require an act of Congress. Questions of a conflict of interest with ADA and Dow continue to go unaddressed, and these actions have both weakened the financial viability of the project and the relationships ADA must maintain with the Alaskans it serves. This is not the time to invest in the largest road construction proposal since the Hall Road, the largest road construction proposal in over 40 years. In statements last week, the governor appeared to think federal funds were also at stake here. How is that possible? ADA's own paperwork clearly states this will not be a federally assisted program. The legislative session is upon us, and the focus will be on smart money and solutions for the state. Your actions as a board will directly affect Alaska's future. there will be intense scrutiny to cut projects. I strongly urge the board to cut this project before wasting millions more. You have the obligation to move the state forward. Since last month's board meeting, Nova Copper, the only current mine proposal in the Ambler District moving forward with any kind of mine proposal at all, lost $10 million in stock value. Just since the last meeting, that was 10 cents on 100 million shares. But this is supposed to be the best road building opportunity in 40 years. I don't understand it, and the Alaskans that I live around don't understand it. The villages in the area are already faced with losing their dividends. The road will be an additional tax on their subsistence lifestyle. The current route would force Dorion to ignore its shareholders that are against the road. Despite Ada's promise that the road will help villages, it would require 150 miles more road to even attach this road to those villages. Do not squander the many opportunities to make a positive contribution to Alaska. The Ambler Road proposal will back us further into the cold, dark corners of fiscal austerity, and it's not investing in Alaskans. Thank you. I'll be holding you to your word.
Your testimony. Any questions from the board? Thank you. Any other comments? All right, we'll close the public hearing portion, public comment portion. Next up is new business. John?
Item 7A is a presentation by the Yukon Custom Health Corporation, also known as YKHC, regarding their plans for construction of a new primary care unit and remodeling of hospital and associated facilities in Bethel, Alaska. Current facility serves a 75,000 square mile area of western Alaska. At this time, I invite Fred Eoff with Public Financial Management Incorporated, also known as PFM, the advisor to YKHC, and the YKHC executive team, including Dan Winkleman, Chief Executive Officer, Tommy Tompkins, Chief Financial Officer, and Newton Chase, Vice President of Support Services, to present, to be available to answer questions, and to call on others who's requesting.
Hold on, Mr. Sherry.
Good afternoon to members of the board. YKHC and its consultants are delighted to be here today and have the opportunity to present an informational briefing to the board on what this project is and a little bit more about what YKHC is. Tommy Tompkins just circulated an additional supplement to this proposal that we elected not to actually make part of the presentation in the interest of your time today. But it does speak a little bit more specifically about the qualifications of the team that YKHC has assembled for this project. The other thing which is in this folder is the full text of a legal opinion relative to the one of the funding sources for this project, which is a linchpin to the overall viability.
For the record, can we get everybody state their names?
I am Fred Eoff with Public Financial Management.
That's correct.
I'm Dan Winkleman. I'm President and CEO of YKHC. I've been with YKHC for almost 15 years now, and been in my role as President and CEO for 2 years.
I'm Newton Chase. I'm the Vice President of Support Services for YKHC. I've been with YKHC about 3 years. But I've been up in Alaska here for about 40 years. First came out to Bethel in 1978. I used to work at Providence Hospital during the Capital Projects. I've worked all over the world doing hospitals. I'm an architect and I'm a hospital administrator.
And I'm Tommy Tompkins, Vice President of Finance, Chief Financial Officer for YKHC.
Thank you. Welcome.
apart from the parties who have introduced themselves here, we have a number of other people that are with us that are part of this project. Kelly Arduino who is a partner with Whiffley, is in charge of the feasibility study for this report. Joseph Pepper, who is president with Davis SKW, is the general contractor for the project. Kent Crandall, who is the senior project for Arcadis, who is the project manager, is also here with us today. Representing USDA, we have Greg Stuckey, who is the director of community facilities for USDA, and Misty Hall, who is the community program specialist with our rural development. We thought Devin Mitchell might be joining today, but I don't believe that he was able to make it.
He's in New York.
Is he? There we go. Also, Anna Latham, who is the director of capital projects with YKHC. Chris Mankey, who I believe introduced himself briefly, director of construction. The point here being that we hope to present is that YKHC has gone to great lengths to, in addition to its very experienced management team, assembled a great depth of qualified team of consultants to assist with this project. Okay, a bit of an executive summary here for the members of the board. YKHC has been in the business of providing health care since 1969, when it was formed on behalf of the 58 recognized tribes in this area, which is approximately 75,000 square miles, and currently serving about 30,000 people. YKHC is the sole certificated healthcare provider in this region, which is larger than the majority of the states.
Greg, just for the board, if they have questions during your presentation, I would encourage them to ask them at that time. So it's topic relevant. So if you hear me break in real quick, it's because one of the board members has a question about something that's up on the.
Absolutely, we would appreciate that as a kind of a collegial dialogue with the board. Thank you. One of the central elements to this program is the joint venture construction program, which is an element of the Indian Health Services. It is a program specifically developed for rural hospital staffing, and the YKHC competed in an open competition in 2015 for participation in this program, was ranked number one out of all applications. YKHC is currently working with IHS to flesh out and finalize implementation of the staffing package for this particular program. Briefly, what this does is the joint venture construction program provides funding for the staff for this project, thus freeing up other revenues that the operation has that can be applied directly to debt service. The project is, and we'll get more deeply into that as we progress through the presentation. The project itself is a new primary care facility in Bethel, remodel the existing hospital, which is old and needs a significant updating, along with remodeling related space. A brief bit on the financial elements of this. The third-party feasibility study, which Kelly Arduino is going to touch on more intensively a little later, is pretty much finished. The financial elements of this project as it stands now is that YKHC is planning to inject $8.2 million of its own cash directly into the construction project. They are going to use $30 million, up to $30 million of their existing cash funded towards reserves and advanced funding for the lockbox structure, which we'll get into a little bit later. USDA has approved $165 million loan for this project, 4 years, committed at 3.625%. This loan is the largest single loan that USDA has ever committed for a single project nationally. The legislature has approved up to $102.5 million to be issued through the bond bank for this financing. We are here with this advanced presentation to ADA. We think ADA has a key role to play in this financing. We're focusing the application to YKHC or to ADA at a $25 million level in a couple of different components. We'll talk about that a little later. We have a line in here for other financing, which may or may not be necessary as it stands right now. I frankly don't think we anticipate other funding sources being needed.
Mr. Chairman.
Fred.
Mr. Yoff, so the sum of the project's a $290 million project.
Correct.
Am I reading that right? Thank
Correct.
You.
One of the key assumptions here is that the IHS funding agreement will be finalized, ratified, and completed before they move forward with the project, before we do any of the finances.
When you refer to a funding agreement, could you give us a little more detail what that really means, a funding agreement?
You want to talk about that?
Under the agreement with IHS, essentially, if we meet all of their requirements, and they have a series of requirements in terms of population services, demand forecast, et cetera, over the next 15 years, essentially, we have, they will pay for all the staffing to staff the new clinic and the hospital and the other spaces. If we will pay for building the clinic to their specifications and their requirements. So one of the things we're working with IHS now is to show that we have met all the requirements, making sure that the population, the demand forecasts, all the financials work exactly the way they want it to work. So as we get to and they sign the lease for 20 years, they will then give us the funding to pay for the staff.
There are fairly strong financial ratios that Elliot Arduino is going to get into a little bit more intensively later, so I won't put it up here. Suffice it to say that the financial strength of YKHC fairly early on in the operational phases here is still quite strong in terms of days cash on hand, operating margin, annual debt service we project at its peak year at about $15.5 million, which is easily fundable under their cash flow. I am going to, at this point, turn this over to Dan Winkleman, who is going to talk to you a little bit more about YKHC itself.
Thanks, Fred. Before we get started, I just want to thank ADA and thank John and both Michaels. We've been working together with ADA for over a year now, although it doesn't seem like that, and the help that they've given us and your ADA team is just fantastic. Really, really appreciate it. ADA's even traveled back to D.C. with us and helped us in our presentation to USDA, so I can't say enough good things about ADA and your team. Really appreciate it. As we start here with our first slide, this is Dr. Paul Johns. Dr. Paul passed away last year. He was one of the founding members of YKHC. Started YKHC, as Fred said, back in 1969 with a group of tribal folks and actually a group of doctors that were at the government hospital and some nurses. They got together and founded YKHC because they wanted to have a voice in how healthcare delivery was going to happen out in the Delta at that time. And so These are some words here that Paul always had talked about at most of our meetings, and I'll just read it. In the past, he was a person who had great faith and pride in himself, would know who he was, and would lead a productive life. If one has great confidence in the indigenous way of life, one's life will be worthwhile. And Paul, that was really Paul's mantra. Paul really, really was a teacher about how we needed to get back to our cultural values, maintain those cultural values. And as Paul's teachings have always said, so long as we do the same with this project, it will be successful as well. As long as it reflects the cultural values of the people of the region and what our needs are out there, this will be a successful project. Next slide. So here's a map. We always start off with a map because we have a big service area. It's Lyme Village. Right here, that's halfway. Here's Bethel, and that's Lyme Village is halfway to Anchorage. It's about 200 air miles away from us and from Bethel, and it's a very large region, about the size of the state of Oregon, about 1.5 times the size of the state of New York. We have 49 different villages that we serve. Besides operating a hospital, we also operate many village clinics in those villages, as well as 5 regional health centers that we call SRCs or sub-regional clinics. And those are in our hub villages. But it's a big place. There's lots of logistical challenges because there's no roads except for a very small road over on the Yukon. But very spread out and large region. Yes, sir.
Where on that map is Donlin Mine?
So Donlin is just outside of Crooked Creek. Here's Crooked Creek right here. Donlin's about right here, just to the right of it.
Would you service Donlin also?
We service everyone in the entire region. And yes, it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're native or non-native, our doors are open to everyone. One of the mandates that we have, we're the only show in town, if you will, so we serve all people. Okay. So like I said, we are a large tribal health organization. We're probably the largest, we are the largest tribal health organization off the road system in Alaska. One of the largest tribal organizations in the nation, if not the largest as well, throughout the Indian Health Services system. We have about 1,300 staff right now. We were organized originally, as Fred said, by the 58 tribes in the YK Delta, and we're also a nonprofit. We had a great year in fiscal year 15. We had about a 15% margin. That's not something that's going to happen in FY 16. We're looking at about a 4.5% margin going forward. But we did have the best year in the company's history, about a $27 million profit is what the books will wrap up saying. We also have strong management capacity. We have had a history of clean audits for many, many years, thanks to Tommy and his team. We've been doing really well with our auditing and their tests that they've been doing over the years. And then we have also $84 million in what we call a permanent fund. That's our investment fund that we started many years ago, and that excludes our operating cash. But we operate that as our permanent fund that's going to backstop this project as well. Our payers, talks about multiple payers. Where does our revenue streams come from? Well, that's the Indian Health Service. They're one of our largest payers. We also have third-party revenues as well, Medicaid, Medicare, and then self-pay. And out of all those revenue streams, Medicaid is really, Medicaid and the Indian Health Service are by far our largest payers in that.
What percentage of your services are paid for, and what percentages you have to write off?
Well, we receive $70 million from the Indian Health Service. That's what our annual compact is. And so what we do is we also receive about $80 million in third-party revenue. We build up, we offer more services than what the Indian Health Service would be paying for. If you're an Alaska Native beneficiary, we're required to have search for all sorts of revenue streams. Whatever revenue you have, we're required to get from you for your services. And if you present and you do not have any sort of private insurance, you don't have any Medicaid or Medicare, then we write that off. And our contractual is how much money?
At this time, we're running a little over 50% in our contractual. It's based on, that's just based on...
What percentage?
It's actually about 50%.
50?
Uh-huh.
That's normal for our healthcare.
Very normal.
So this is how we like to describe YKHC in our health system. It's a four-tier health system. It starts out in our villages, as I mentioned. We have 44 village clinics, and then we have 5 sub-regional clinics within our region. This is a good example of what most of our village clinics look like now. We've done over $200 million worth of construction in region by YKHC over the last 20 years. At reconstructing these with partnered with Denali Commission, Rasmussen, and others in the state of Alaska to do that. Our services as far as who staffs those in the villages, those are done by our community health aid practitioners, and they're really our first line of health care that we have. They offer primary care. They're also first responders when there's emergencies, and so they do everything with the assistance of our physician teams that we have back in the hospital at Bethel. At our sub-regional services, if you needed a higher level of care, you would be referred to one of those from our villages. And again, we have 5 of those. They're a larger facility. They're around 15,000 square feet plus in size. We staff those with mid-level providers, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and the like. We also have digital x-ray capacity. We have a larger ER area, trauma room, if you will, larger pharmacy, as I said. And so just offering a higher level of care at those SRCs. And if you need a higher level of care, you may be referred directly or through the SRC to the Bethel Hospital that was built back in 1980 and 81. That was originally designed as a 50-bed hospital. We have that down to about 36 now. And if you needed a different or higher level of care or some sort of major surgery or tertiary care, you'd be referred to Anchorage, to the Alaska Native Medical Center, or perhaps regional or FOB, or even outside of Seattle. We also operate, we have a joint venture with Providence, Alaska. We operate the largest medevac operation in the state. We do over 2,000 missions a year. It's called Lightman. Excellent. So as far as a little bit about our management that we have in place internally, we have 50 plus years of hospital management. I've expanded my senior leadership team to about 9. Several of them are here today, accompanying me. Many years' experience on the team. We also have some solid performance as well. As I mentioned, last year was the best year that we've had in YKHC's history. We've been operating since 1969, and as Fred likes to say, we have the ability to make hard decisions still when needed, and have done that in the past on many occasions. As far as healthcare construction, Newton Shea Series has over 20 plus years of extensive experience, not only in Alaska and rural Alaska, but also throughout the world. The largest facility you worked on was what, the 500-bed facility in Abu Dhabi?
Yeah, Cleveland Abu Dhabi.
And besides Newton, the company itself, and Chris and others in Deanna, we have extensive experience. As I mentioned, we've done over $200 million worth of construction. We have our own construction crew that we force account. Any of those projects I spoke about earlier about the villages and all that construction that happened with the new clinics, we did all those ourselves. It's something that's pretty unique to YKHC that you won't find with the other tribal organizations. We've also put together some top advisors, as you can see here, and really what we're talking about are really industry leaders. And we have the Innova Group that's helping us out on our planning. They're the same group that the Indian Health Services use. We have Dave Mather and Associates from Fairbanks. He's really an expert on the Indian Health Service and how their funding structure works and appropriations. As far as on our design build side, we have Bettysworth North out of Fairbanks, also ZGF, which is a national health architectural group, and they're together with Jones & Jones
Jones & Jones is our cultural lead and cultural architect, and he was actually the principal who designed the Smithsonian's Museum of the American Indian. And so we've brought him on board, and that's really our tripartite team that we have on the design build side, as well as many Alaska firms on the engineering side and one international firm. And then we have our contractor, Davis Constructors, and SKW, that we've selected. On the finance side, we have PFM, Fred and his team, Whitley, as well as doing a third-party feasibility assessment, which we'll get into in a little bit. And then our funding partners, as of right now, our USDA has committed $165 million to this project, plus the Municipal Bond Bank. Craig talked about them, and then hopefully ADA as well. As far as project management goes, we realize this is really a complex and large project, and so we really selected the best folks we could find. And so we brought on Kent from Arcadis and his team to help us with project management and NorTech. Excellent. So let's get into why the project's important.
Real quickly, could you speak to the length of the project, how many folks will be the construction employment, and then how many folks will be at the facility, permanent jobs?
Yeah, so it's a five-year project. We're looking at bringing in at least 300 new staff. And there's a range there. We'll get into that. We have some detailed slides on that. This slide here, this is important because Indian Health Service, when I came on board, there's so many challenges that we have. Most of them are about funding. Not enough funding, not enough resources, not enough staff. So how was I going to be able to deal with all these issues we have out in the YK Delta? We're one of the few areas in Bush, Alaska that's actually growing. And we have a lot of people that are leaving out migration, but we have a lot more young families that are growing up in a very high birth rate out in our region. And so we have a lot more people that are staying, even though we do have a lot of out migration as well. And so we're projected to increase over the next 10 years with a 19% growth rate. And that's why Indian Health Service has this joint venture program, is to deal with these sorts of issues where they look across their system, and basically they have this program that with so many dollars, tribes will have to compete, tribal organizations, to try to get those dollars. And as Fred mentioned, we're number one, we're ranked number one in that process. But that's how we're able to get additional funding, is through this project, and that's how we're going to deal with this population growth, is through the staffing package that the Indian Health Service is going to make available to us. Next slide. So poverty, this is a very important slide as well. We have a lot of poverty out in our region. It's what the USDA calls a strike force region. Strike force is really just USDA's mission, is one of their missions is how they're going to increase economic growth within a rural area. And Bethel in our region, as you can see from the statistics there, we have high unemployment, not just in Bethel, but out in our villages, which is even higher. And we have a large percentage of families that are under the poverty level. That's how we're going to deal with this issue, is, and why it's so attractive to our funding partners, is because this is about economic growth. It's about real economic growth. But more than that, it's about increasing access to health care, which is something that's sorely needed out in the White Delta.
Mr. Chairman?
Fred?
Just a quick point, but wasn't the Wade Hampton census area renamed Casilda?
Yes, yeah, Kuzulik. That's a good catch. So as far as population health, what's going on in the YK Delta, this is a snapshot of mortality here. What we've seen over the years, historically, if you looked at Bush, Alaska, you'll see for many, many, many decades, unintentional injuries has been the number one cause of death. We're seeing that switch now. We're seeing cancer out in our region and in other areas of Alaska. We're seeing the number one reason for mortality is cancer. And with us, the YK Delta is very close. These numbers here are per 100,000. But our number one killers out in our region are, like I said, cancer, unintentional injuries. And then it drops down. What we've been seeing over the years is heart disease, which was almost non-existent. As the diet has changed and as exercise has decreased, we're seeing heart disease increase as well out in the YK Delta. And then we have a very, very large suicide rate. If you look at our suicide rates and breakout, the 15 to 24-year-olds, very, very high, 17 times the national average, unfortunately, is what our suicide rate is. You know, these are real numbers. You know, they're not just numbers themselves, they're real. It was yesterday, we had another suicide out in Tuxac, and I did a weekly report. And for the last couple of weeks, we've had several suicides just in the YK Delta. It's affected my family tremendously. I've had six people who are immediate family members commit suicide. My grandfather, my great uncle, my first cousin, my aunt, my uncle, and another first cousin. And so it's really it's something that's very horrible, and it's something that we need to do a better job of. Next slide. So let's get to the what. Next slide. Here's a project in a nutshell. Here is our admin building on this side. On the first floor on that admin building, we have dental, optometry, and behavioral health. Then we have a highway bisecting our campus, and we have the existing hospital right here. One of the great things about this project is we're going to take all of our primary care services and get them to one place. We don't have to have, we have high traffic crossing the road here. It's something that I'm always worried about as one of the leaders of the organization, that someone's going to get hurt there in doing that. So our plan is to move out dental, optometry, behavioral health from the first floor of this building across over here. And the tan and the red portions are our conceptual drawings of the new facility. And essentially what that means is with the existing hospital, we're going to renovate it, and then we're going to pull out our primary care clinics and move them to this facility and expand those, and then that's where dental, optometry, and behavioral health will go as well. Next question. As far as services that will be supported, two big things here. We're going to integrate our model of care. So what that means is we offer all these different service lines. And when you come to see us, our traditional model is we made patients go to different places in the hospital and to get their services, and then we'd also do referrals as well. And what we're doing now is we're going to totally change that. We're going to go to the patient for the first time. And so we're in the process right now of integrating our model of care. That's an evidence-based best practice that the best healthcare systems in the nation have already done. And we're integrating our services to really bring those services to the patients. So it can reduce their referral time, it'll increase quality, and it will really increase continuity of care as well. And then how we're going to improve access. In my visits to the villages, this is not just about making Bethel bigger, the services offered in Bethel. This is really about improving access. And I'm always asked, well, how are you going to do that for Tuxac or a different village? Well, we're, for the first time with additional staff, what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to send those doctors, those mid-levels, those dentists out to the villages on a regular cycle. And we're going to be able to bring those services out from Bethel to people's homes because, as I mentioned, the high poverty area, we've also seen the price of energy increase tremendously over the last 15 years, except as of late. But airfares are extremely high out in our region. To go from Kotlik or any of our outlying regions into Bethel and to get back home, it costs our patients over $600 to do that. And when you don't have any money, you're just going to forget about that, paying for that. And you're going to push off what needs to be done regarding your health care until something bad happens. And so we need to get out and change that model and get out of Bethel. And the only way we can do that is through this increase in staff.
Mr. Chairman?
What's DGSF?
Department Gross Square Feet. So it's just a planning measure that we have to use to
comply with IHS.
That's trying to get designated general fund out of it.
No, it's not. It's a step before finance.
Thank you.
Excellent. So I'm going to hand off to my partner, Newton, at this point. Court Whiting, so 5 years is the project term. Essentially, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be building the clinic first. So we can move the existing clinics out of the hospital, move them in, create an empty chair at the hospital, start renovating that in a number of phases. Clinic finishes up, if you look at this, clinic will finish up in the summer of 2019. Hospital finishes up in the summer of 2021, if you will. But it's all fast track. It's all moving very, very quickly. So schedule-wise, as you all know, in the Bush construction, it's all about the barges. It's all about when you get what material in and maximizing the labor, and you're minimizing your mobilization and your general condition costs, if you will. So we want to get the pilings on early barge this year so we get the pile out there. We can drive pile all summer and in the winter. Next year, we'll put the structural steel on after it's been fabricated, and we will start hanging steel on the early barge. And then we'll start building up that clinic. So you can see, so the construction on the clinic starts this summer, but it's really the piling, the pad, that sort of thing. The hospital construction starts just as we wind up the clinic. Clinic complete in 2016, open, hospital complete, and then some of the back remodeling, because we're moving people out of different clinics, and then moving ahead. So it's a full fast track, very quick, but it's all about cost management and time management. That's the reason Josh and Chris are here. That's what our focus is. Here's a quick on the project budget. And
how does that construction schedule tie into your financing?
The way we're doing right now, what we're working on now, you saw the $8.2 million that was on that early sheet. That's our construction. That's our money that we put in that's funding what we're doing right now. You know, we do not have the IHS agreement in place. We will not sign the IHS, the agreements with any of our USDA or your folks or with the Municipal Bond Bank until we have that IHS agreement signed. We're expecting that to be signed hopefully later this winter or early spring. We're working very hard on it to get all their requirements with those DGSS and all those staffing numbers that you're talking about, making sure that we can get that signed and then we'll... So the financing that we have in the springtime, late spring, early summer, again, we have enough of cash that we have right now that we've committed that we can keep moving.
So you would bring the barge in and the piling regardless?
Yeah, we'll go ahead and order that and put it in. Okay. And then we'll start driving pile in the middle of the summer. We can drive pile all the way through the winter if we have to, depending on what Josh wants to do. You know, what makes most cost sense.
So is your design finished?
No, we're in concept design. We just finished up concept design. We need a hold there until we get the agreements in place that we know we've got the size and square footage that the IHS will support and the staffing. And that's the reason why you see the draft feasibility study. We'll finalize that when we get those numbers absolutely nailed down. Does that make sense? So if it's a fast track, you move it as fast as you can go. You check it out, then move ahead, check, move ahead. Same thing on the budget. Does that answer your question?
Sure. Yeah, just the design is finalized. It doesn't have any effect on the end result and the final cost of the project. Anticipate 90%, 80% designed, or where do you stop? I mean, this is a delta risk. Is there any delta risk between?
Well, this as an architect, I'm in charge, and particularly in the bush, because I've done a number of bush trucks, there's always a risk, but we're managing to minimize that risk all the way through, if you will. So what we're basically doing, we did a cost estimate on concepts, with the architects. Josh is in about 2 weeks is going to have a stick built estimate, and to double check that. So we're always checking against cost. When we do the schematics design, we'll check against cost again. We'll ask Josh to do a real check in independently with estimations out of Fairbanks. So we're always going to be checking back and forth.
because we've always got to know we've got a viable project.
So will the John, will the loan request come in with the finalized construction budget and finalized design?
Yes.
So this is a quick snapshot. This is using the USDA format of the budget as and when we submit it to USDA. So you can start to see a bit of the spread. To answer your earlier question here, right now we're posting the $287 million to do the math relative to the, we're asking up to $25 million from you folks for consideration when it comes up to you actually for as an application. So we will, right now we're not anticipating asking for the full amount, but we want to make sure you knew what the upside number would be. But I don't need to go through a lot of the detail here, but just to show you that we're constantly checking against cost, we're constantly checking against our budgets. This is really what the bottom line is. Okay? Let me turn it over to Tommy.
Is there a clicker or someone's on that?
You're
the clicker? Thank you, Fred. As mentioned, I represent Whipley. We are an accounting and consulting firm. You probably aren't familiar with the name, but it is actually a gentleman, Clarence Whipley, who started the firm in 1930. So we've been around for a few years. And we really specialize in working with middle market, smaller, rural businesses of all kinds. Healthcare is one of our major industries that we serve, and there's a lot of idiosyncrasies about how healthcare gets paid, especially in rural. And then you add into the mix Indian Health, and I believe that's part of the reason that we were hired, because we do have that deep expertise in a lot of those idiosyncratic kind of revenue streams. So we are doing the, what I'll call the examined financial forecast. I think we have one gentleman who may have some CPA background, yes. But for those layman people, we threw around the word feasibility study. Okay, simply put, a feasibility study is just what's the market and what are the revenues resulting from those volumes in your market and what does that look like? You can make up anything. You can say we're going to grow 2%, we're going to grow 4%. Whatever. Okay, it's just a modeling of the future. An examined financial forecast has very specific meaning for CPAs and for anyone who's doing any kind of financing. It basically is what I would call an audit of the future. All of the underlying revenue streams and expenses are treated as they would be in an audit. Now, we prepared a feasibility study, which is in draft form, and some of the AIDA folks and AMBBA and USDA have seen it, but it will look just like any kind of audit financial statement that you've seen, but behind that are many, many procedures and documentation of the actual revenue flows of the bad debt. I know we drove Tommy and his staff crazy with our various questions on it, and the reason is because in the end, we as a firm put our opinion that the assumptions about growth and the future performance are reasonable and valid. So you actually put the onus on the feasibility consultant, the examined opinion on the viability of the project. So I think that's an important distinction. The, you know, it ends up being a 100-page report. It details not only the nature of the project, the size of the project, the population in the area, a lot of the elements that Dan went over earlier on about the project, as well as detailed assumptions about all of the buildup of the assumptions, even going into things like what is the working capital that they're going to be spending on an ongoing basis over and above just this project. What does any existing debt look like? What does any kind of recruitment look like? So that is being prepared, and that is actually a requirement of USDA financing. Both AIDA and AMBBA, of course, will also be signing off on that. Any questions? the purpose of today is not to go through the feasibility study, the examined forecast, but to give you a sense of what's coming and some of the preliminary work that has been done so far. One of the key things we keep hearing about is this JVCP, Joint Venture Construction Program Funding Agreement. That's been a little bit of a moving target. I think we have some more clarity around that. On the low end, that's going to be approximately additional $30 million a year. On the high end, $60 million. Maybe up to $80. It's, again, moving target. We, in the modeling and in the rate debt ratios that you're going to see on the next page, assume the lower amount of 30. So note that those ratios are based on that most conservative amount. In general, on all the assumptions, we tend to go more conservative because it certainly is our opinion on it. And I think it's really important to understand that when that funding agreement is in place, and it's based on a formula of FTEs and demand for services in the area and salaries for those FTEs, it doesn't mean that on day one you have to have all those FTEs hired. You're going to get these folks, YKHC will get that money to operate. They will hire some people over time, they will ramp up, but it doesn't automatically offset $1 with expenses. So that extra funding, that's why it makes such a big difference. And we're going to see a real example of that at the end when we talk about the financing study, of how that additional dollars goes to cover operations that are kind of ramping up over time but won't have all the expenses associated with them right out of the gate. And then again, you can see we've got in an area with 15.9% growth, we're going to be projecting very minimal inpatient growth, outpatient primary care and specialty care, which is really, that's where the mental health, that's where some of the heart disease, that's where those other services come in. And we literally go every single department and say, how many are we expecting to have of X number of cases? What's the average reimbursement for those? And then rolling them. So again, 100-page report, one slide. Preliminarily, and this is what was presented to USDA, you can see some of the key ratios that we're looking at. In 2022, that will be the first year of debt service when all of the loans are flipped to permanent and funded. So that will be kind of their maximum debt service year. And they're at a positive 8.9% operating margin. I will tell you, having worked on, maybe 75 different rural hospitals that have been replaced, it is more typical to see a negative operating margin for at least 5 years when you do a big project like this. And the reason is because one of your line items in your expenses is depreciation. It's not cash, right? So to have such a positive operating margin, I think, is pretty remarkable. And again, that's a funding agreement. EBITDA, how much money are you making before you talk about interest and depreciation on the debt? That's very strong, 14.1%. A target for most rural hospitals is about 10%. Days cash on hand, 364. I think the other thing that's notable is that the trend is going up. It's not going down. They've slowed their increase of the cash, but it's still doing very well. And then they're at about 50% debt to capitalization, how much they owe on what they owe. So room still for other borrowing. And then this other factor, which is going to be very, very important, is this revenue pledge component. In this scenario, YKHC is going to be pledging third-party revenues, meaning put that Indian Health money aside that you're getting, but we can use the money that we get from Medicare, from Medicaid, from any other commercial payer, from self-pay. And that's about $80 million. Okay? So if your debt payment annually is about $15.5 million and you're getting $80 million in the door that is pledged specifically for debt, that's about a 5.16 debt service coverage. That's how many times over you could pay that $15.5 million annually. So that's where I draw.
Is the Indian Health Service guaranteed subject to federal appropriation on an annual basis?
Yes, one of the things that why we provided this letter at the back of this is a letter from Sanofi, Cambridge, et cetera. I can't remember all the names. But it is gives you a background in terms of that very question. And it basically gets down to several points. One is this a treaty and trust obligation relative to the federal government and providing the source of funds. There's over 20 years of experience with the JDCP project, you know, with IHS, and they have determined. Basically, what they do is when they get the application, goes to Congress, to OMB, et cetera, once it gets appropriated, it continues on. It gets into their base, the funding base, and then we'll continue. So, the other thing that says is that the 20 years, well, it's a 20 year lease, the funding will be continuous, even beyond.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I read that letter while we were sitting here today, and it's very strong, but it's not perfect. In our own state history, the governor's veto of $200 million in tax credits was certainly a deferral or a delay in a payment of an obligation of the state, and the controversy surrounding the legislative office building is premised on the same issue in the lease for that building as to the ability of a current legislator to bind a future legislature to an appropriation. So I think that's a risk that will need to be considered and addressed. And this document is strong. I appreciate it, but I leave it to Mr. Springton to and his staff to ferret out the nuances of how we properly protect ourselves.
One point I will make is that certainly we know Medicare and Medicaid is I would say, probably more risky than IHS funding in terms of the changes that they could potentially make. That said, USDA regularly makes loans on rural hospitals that get a very specific kind of Medicare funding called critical access hospitals, like HD is not one. So they felt like, well, we're part of the rationale was that we're making loans on the basis of Medicare in something that is more fragile than, say, IHS.
Mr. Chairman, that actually brings to mind a third example from within Alaska, which is the Secretary of Health has, I want to use the word carefully, it's not defaulted, but they have failed to make risk corridor payments that were called for under the Affordable Care Act and thus jeopardized the balance sheet of a number of insurance providers, including at least one of our major operations in this state. So it's manageable risk, but it does represent something that has to be considered.
So on a preliminary look, and I think that as we're kind of refining the plan of finance, looking at the timing, looking at the way to reduce the capitalized interest that accrues as the project is constructed, it's probably going to look better, but in that early draft, I mean, those financial ratios just blew away, you know, anything that USDA has ever seen. And so that plus the importance of the project, where it's located, I think really hit home to USDA, the ability to support the project. And I know that our firm will have absolutely no issue providing an opinion that it's feasible.
So we're going to touch on the debt structure now and how that's secured. This basically is the conversation we just had. It's basically the underpinnings of the financing is the strength of the IHS contact. You raised a very good point. It's duty to be evaluated. The history of this program is quite solid. The JDCP has funded 30 projects since 1993. Once those individual contracts are appropriated, the funding has consistently held up quite well.
Yeah, and then Fred, just to add to that, we've had four successful joint venture projects that just recently came online in the last couple of years. right here in Alaska. South Central Foundation's new clinic up at Valley, San Juan Chiefs Conference Super Clinic in Fairbanks, Copper River Native Association's new clinic in the Glen Allen area, and then the Kainai Tribe's new facility in Kenai. And those are examples that are right here at home, plus the 20, almost 30 plus other awardees that have happened for the last 20 plus years by Congress. IHS, every time they've asked for additional appropriations for the staffing package increases, they've received them. Project has started. It's something that Congress, congressmen and senators really like, is the joint venture construction program, because they're not paying for a new hospital. The tribal organizations do it. And they really, really like that. So rather than IHS having to go out and fund a new hospital plus the staff that goes in it, they're only having to do the staff. And so from Congress's point of view and the senators, they really, really like this project a lot.
Any we touched on this earlier. This is basically the way the financing plan is designed now. It is a five-year project. We visualize the financing's coming into this on a phased basis over time. The plan is to bring the $102.5 million from the bond bank on initially as early in 2016 as we possibly can. That is, we do have some rate exposure there. We'd like to take advantage of the current market and get that accomplished fairly quickly. The ADA loan, should you view this favorably, we see coming on board not until 2018, and then USDA, the first phase, there's two phases of the USDA loan. They're really, the USDA does not provide construction finance. So we need to complete the clinic phase of the project, which then would allow a closure of the first phase of the financing, and then complete the hospital phase of the program, which would allow closure of the last piece of the overall ADA. Alone. So these finances, as it plans, as it's planned now, come in place over a four-year period of time out to 2020. Interest assumptions on the bond bank loan, we're assuming, based on current market and a little bit of a margin of four, we're assuming 5.25% on the ADA loan. That's obviously your programmatic determination. The USDA loans, the beauty of these two loans is they're 40-year loans. Those interest rates are committed. They're not subject to market. Point here is the ADA loan is, we consider that to be a variable. The ask here is for up to a $25 million loan based on the current budget. We don't anticipate that we need the full $25.5 million at the end of the project. This, given the phasing of the construction drawdowns, there's a spot through the middle of the construction program where the $25 million would be very helpful to have to bridge construction expenditures for about a one-year period of time. Post that, we may well be able to reduce the ADA loan back down to $10.6 million, again, assuming the project budget holds up, which would then be the portion that's amortized over time.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Fred.
Fred and perhaps Mr. Springsteen, but as we consider that, I just would like some thought from the staff as to the consequences to us of tying up our balance sheet if, in fact, it's just a backstop. Is there some other way to structure a backstop? And I don't have a concrete idea, and I'm interested in the project, but I just want to know its consequences.
Or construction loan for short term. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know,
I will say that one of the reasons that we did feel that it would be very helpful, very useful to bring ADA in as part of this funding is because you do have a lot of resources and you do have other things that you may be able to provide short-term, long-term that might be useful bridging through the construction period of this program. So that's why we very much like to have ADA as a partner in this project. This is an overall project sources and uses. You can see the USDA loan at $165 million, the bond bank at $102.5 million, ADA in here at full $25 million, YKCE contributing $8.2 million directly to project disbursements. YKHC will also be contributing additional funding for reserves. Those would be local share reserves required by the bond bank and presumably also by Hale. And then based on the drawdown schedule, we're assuming about $860,000+ of positive income on the construction project. This is the core project, which ties to the project budget that Newton summarized a while ago. Again, 7.5 went into local share reserves, $14 million+ we're projecting. Post-construction, coming back to reduce the original $25 million loan from A to D, and I think that makes sense. Any questions about that? Okay. This is kind of the what I kind of call the meat of the coconut here in terms of the financing and why it works. This is the overall operational flow of funds. But here is the funds coming in from Indian Health Services under the expanded compact in conjunction with this project, which funds staff and operational costs directly, thus freeing up the third-party revenues for Medicare, Medicaid, and third-party Medicare and Medicaid, which doesn't have to then flow down to the bottom line on a net basis to fund debt service. So the concept is that those three revenues will flow into a lockbox structure, and that out of that lockbox, the first priority waterfall of funds, first priority use of these funds will flow to debt service on a parity basis between the ADA loan, bond bank loan, and the USDA loan.
Mr. Chairman, are we first in that waterfall, or did you, when you say parity basis, it's all three?
Concept would hopefully be that all parties have a pari passu claim on revenue. So there's a consistent allocation of
proportionate to the underlying debt.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Proportionate to the underlying debt.
Proportionate to the amount of
loan.
The individual loans, yes. As a first priority claim, debt service projected peak year, $15.5 million. This number is approximately 80. So it gets to the coverage that Kelly mentioned earlier of 5 times. This fundamentally is, you could argue that this is a gross pledge to debt of the third part of these revenue sources. Second priority, release of funds after debt service from the lockbox flows back to YKHC for regular operational expenditures.
Mr. Chairman, so that's on an annual basis then?
Yes. The other thing that I'd like to point out here is this, the flow of debt service. The concept here is that YKHC will apply existing funds to advance seed the lockbox here, so that you're always 1 year ahead of the obligations that need to come out of this lockbox to debt service. We've used this structure with the Alaska Railroad debt structure, where their advance funding debt by a year, it's been a pretty instrumental factor in negotiating a significantly reduced debt service reserve requirement with the rating agencies. But it fundamentally does give you an additional buffer to be able to weather through unexpected circumstances.
So on operations, so utilities, or when that comes out of the IHSS, or does it come from the lockbox back to operation at the YKHC?
In terms of IHS, they give us money to actually pay for the utility costs for the new spaces. That's part of the lease. That's actually separate from the staffing piece.
So I know there's been some questions along the way. Happy to address any other questions that you all may have.
Gary,
so there's a fairly robust discussion going on over in that area in regards to forming a borough to
take the advantages of local government. I'd be interested in two questions. Are you involved in that? And two, would that type of local government organization help this project, hinder it, or is it not?
I'm unimportant.
We participated in some of those discussions. They're pretty preliminary at this juncture, and I can't see how that would affect this project.
It doesn't give you a great big yellow. It doesn't give you a great big red flag or a big green flag. It's just okay. Okay, thank you.
Well, you mentioned that you had a construction company. Will this construction company be working on this project, and will it be subcontracted to Davis or SKW, or will they be the lead?
Go ahead. For this project, we have secured Davis Constructors along with SKW Joint Venture Partnership because we believe we want to bring that level of expertise in. And what we're working on is that they... because we're committed to local hire and training our staff, as you can sort of see, it's about jobs and it's about bringing the trade skills up, that we will be working closely with them to allow them to, we'll give them the labor pool, if you will, to select from, that they will hire and be responsible from while we keep our own cadre for the other things that we're building. There will be some small pieces that we may carve out, like the remodeling of that administrative office building that Dan was talking about, and some of the other things related to housing and some of the other things. But we think this project demands a top drawer firm like Davis and SKW to come in.
So self performance would be very little.
In very little.
Further questions from the board? Gentlemen, we appreciate this great presentation. We see a lot of effort was put into it. Appreciate your patience and time taken today to give us this presentation. And look forward to hearing more about the project as it gets closer to D-Day or Barge Day.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thank you all for the time.
Thank you.
Great.
All right. So there's been a request for a 5-minute coffee break.
10 minutes.